Welcome back to the program. Yesterday marked the 100th birthday of Rosa Parks, one of the most widely known women of the 20th century. When she died in October of 2005, her body was placed in the Capitol Rotunda, where 40,000 Americans paid tribute to her passing. She was the recipient of the nation's two highest honors, the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor. She has become an icon of the civil rights movement, but unfortunately, as often happens with many iconic figures, their memory becomes about one incident. In the case of Rosa Parks, about a single act on a bus. Unfortunately, that ignores a life fighting for civil rights and freedom. We're going to talk about the entire scope of Rosa Parks' life today with my guest, Jean Theo Harris. Jean is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, the author of six previous books and numerous articles on black freedom struggle and contemporary politics and race in America. It is my pleasure to welcome Jean Theo Harris here to talk about the rebellious life of Rosa Parks. Jean, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. How is it that Rosa Parks has become, as you've said, a kind of children's book hero, that we have lost sight of the entire scope of her life and really remember only one incident on a bus, an incident that was in some ways a replay of something that had happened 10 years before?
Absolutely, and was in many ways the culmination of many acts of courage that she had taken to sort of get to that moment on December 1st, 1955. I think in the process of kind of lifting her up, it also fit with a kind of political moment to kind of just focus on one act as if one act on one day can reshape the course of American history, when in fact it's obviously much harder. It took her much more work, and it obviously took many, many people struggled to get to that moment on December 1st, 1955, you know, which then turns into this mass movement in Montgomery.
Which always sort of begs the question of what would have happened if that moment hadn't happened, if Rosa Parks hadn't been on that bus that day, and how it might have changed the face and the direction of the struggle.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that this is a long time in coming, right? She has made multiple stands on the bus. Other people in Montgomery over the decades since World War II had made stands on the bus. There is a group of people in Montgomery. This is Edie Nixon, who is a sleeping car porter, union activist. He's there. Joanne Robinson, who's the head of the Women's Political Council, a young black lawyer in town by the name of Fred Gray. Obviously a young, very young Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy. There's many people in place in Montgomery, right, that turn her act into a movement. And obviously Rosa Parks herself, with Edie Nixon, had spent a decade working with the NAACP to transform the Montgomery branch into a more activist chapter, working on voter registration, working on school desegregation, and working to document white brutality against black people. So this in many ways is the fruits of many people's labors that come together, you know, in the boycott. But I think if she hadn't done that day, if the bus driver hadn't taken the extra step to arrest her, right? She had been thrown off the bus by this bus driver, as you mentioned, 12 years earlier. She hated the practice that many Montgomery bus drivers insisted on, where black people would have to pay in the front, get off the bus, and reboard from the back. She refused to do that. She'd been thrown off the bus by this bus driver. She'd been thrown off the bus by other bus drivers. Other people she knew had also engaged in similar acts of resistance. One of her neighbors, in fact, had been killed in 1950 for his bus resistance. So, again, the feeling is growing, but certainly her act galvanizes it.
Do you think that the way she has become such an iconic figure for that one incident in some ways diminishes the entire scope of her life's work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it works with a kind of, again, a political moment we're in now, right, where we want to see this as a post-racial society, and so lifting up her in this one moment is in many ways, unfortunately, a way of putting the civil rights movement in the past, when the actual Rosa Parks, right, continued struggling for decades and decades, up really until the end of her life in 2005. You know, she insisted that there was still much work to be done, that there was still racial injustice, there was still social inequality, and she was committed to kind of working on that to the end. And yet the way she's memorialized puts all of this safely in the past, and I think mistakenly puts it in the past.
The other aspect is this political attitude that she brought to bear. And while she certainly respected Dr. King, Malcolm X was really her political hero.
Right. I mean, and I think one of the things we can learn from her is the ways that these King and Malcolm are not opposites, right? She's inspired by King, loves King, right? She, as you mentioned, calls Malcolm X her personal hero. Ella Baker, longtime organizer Ella Baker, is one of her mentors, as is Septima Clark from Highlander Folk School, right? I mean, she exists in a very rich political milieu, and she, you know, she in many ways is inspired and inspires, you know, many, many sort of black activists and, of course, white activists, right? And Malcolm, she meets Malcolm X for the first time in 1963, in part because he very much wants to meet her, too. He is awed by her courage, just as she is sort of impressed by him.
Talk a little bit about some of her early organizing activities, because as we've talked about, she had a very active political life long before that incident in 1955.
Absolutely. So, in many ways, it begins with her family. She's raised by her mother and her grandparents. Her grandfather is a supporter of Marcus Garvey, right, Pan-Africanist, black nationalist Marcus Garvey. So in many ways, her spirit is nurtured by her family and by their belief that you act respectably, but you also expect respect and you demand respect. So she remembers sitting out with her grandfather after World War One. The Klan rages through Alabama, and he sits outside with a shotgun, and she sometimes sits with him. She marries Raymond Parks. She talks about Raymond Parks as the first real activist I ever met. Raymond Parks, when she meets him and marries him, is working on the Scottsboro case, which is nine African-American young men, ages 12 to 19, who'd been arrested for riding the rails, for riding a train, and that arrest turns to a rape charge. They're quickly sentenced to death. And so Raymond and many other local activists kind of rise up to try to defend and free the Scottsboro boys. And so that's what he's doing when she meets him. So in many ways, her political life as an adult begins with the Scottsboro case. Then in 1943, she sees a picture of a former classmate of hers attending a local Montgomery NAACP meeting and realizes that women can also go. And she's wanting to register to vote. And so she goes down to the branch meeting, and she is the only woman there that day, so she's elected secretary. They're having branch elections, so she becomes the secretary that very first day. And Edie Nixon, who is a sleeping car porter, who's very active in the union, who's a very kind of stalwart activist in Montgomery, comes by her house to bring her some materials about voter registration. You know, and that partnership really will change the course of American history. And so for the next decade, her and Edie Nixon work to change the Montgomery branch of the NAACP into a more activist branch. She travels the state for many of those years, taking testimony, recording incidents of white brutality and legal malfeasance against black people. They work on voter registration. They work on school desegregation. Right. So she, and in many ways, this is a decade of hard struggle and of very frustrating struggle, because most of what they're doing, you know, they're challenging it. They're saying this is wrong, but it's not going very far. And so in many ways, understanding how she gets to this moment on December 1st, 1955 is also understanding how frustrating and how almost burned out, right, she is, because, you know, she's taking stand after stand after stand, and again, white resistance, white supremacy is so strong.
I mean, it goes back with her even to her early education, as you talk about it, at Miss White's School for Girls.
Miss White's School for Girls, in many ways, is an offshoot of a kind of similar education that Booker T. Washington is promoting. So it very much is teaching the young black women who go to the school. Let me back up. There was no education for black students past the sixth grade when Rosa Parks was in school. So her mother, at great sacrifice, sends her to Miss White's School for Girls, which is a school for black girls, again, set up in the sort of model of Booker T. Washington, but very much inculcates the young woman there, not just in kind of the domestic sciences, but also in a sense of kind of pride and sort of that they can, you know, and self-determination. And so I think in many ways that education, and Rosa Parks' friends at school sort of regard her a bit as a goody-two-shoes. She's very rule-following. She doesn't, you know, they don't let you dance. They don't let you have long hair. They don't let you see movies. And she sort of abides by this. And yet at the same time, she has this sort of feisty side. Her and her brother get threatened by a white bully, and she picks up a brick and threatens to hit him, and the bully backs down. In another instance, when she's a young person, a young white boy pushes her off the sidewalk. She pushes him back in front of his mother. The mother says, you know, basically, I could kill you. And Rosa Parks says, well, I didn't want him pushing me. Right? So she has this feisty side, again, that we see as a young person. And that, again, will grow over the course of her life and continue long, long after the bus boycott.
She also incorporates the way in which segregation and the viciousness of it at that point really was impacting women.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that we think about what the bus means, the bus is very much a space of terror, if you will, right? I mean, to make the stand that she makes, she knows, as she said, that she might not get out of there alive. She knows that women have been arrested and raped, right, in police custody. Women, I mean, black people in general on the bus are called names often by the bus driver, and women are called particularly derogatory names. So in many ways, I think when we think about her act of bus resistance, we need to see that as about a kind of act, not just about a full dignity on the bus, mm-hmm. that includes a dignity as a woman as well.
Talk a little bit about how she incorporated in her own views the black power, her embrace of parts of the Black Panther Party, mm-hmm. and how that all came together for her.
Okay. So she, you know, again, long before the boycott, right, she's working on things like, you know, trying to change the criminal justice system. She's working on cultivating independent black political power. The revelation of black history is an amazing discovery for Parks when she's, a young person, a teenager. All these things, right, that were important to her. She's also sort of an internationalist, right? She's a very early opponent of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. So all of these politics that she has with her by the mid to late 60s intersect with a growing black power movement, and she very much, you know, participates in and alongside that, and in many ways, I think, doesn't see that as necessarily distinct from things that she'd been doing in the past, and obviously is heartened by this kind of new spirit, this new militancy. I use in the book a metaphor of a quilt to kind of, Rosa Parks was a quilter, and in many ways, I think we want to see black power in terms of the quilt of black protest as she might see it, so that it's just one of many, you know, kind of strands in this, again, awesome quilt of black struggle in the 20th century.
One of the other aspects of what she brought to it was seeing it from a working class point of view, that the leadership of the movement at the time tended to be more middle class.
Absolutely.
And more male.
Yes. So, I mean, interestingly, Rosa Parks is living in the projects when she, again, makes her bus stand. She is working class. She will be, in many ways, working class her whole life. In many ways, her and Edie Nixon, when they kind of move to take the branch in a more activist direction, are very much opposed by many middle-class members of the Montgomery branch who are of a different class status, who don't want this kind of politics. They try to unseat Nixon, which they do not succeed in doing. But in many ways, I think if we want to see why the boycott emerges, I think it emerges in part because she lives on Montgomery's working class West Side. Working class people identify with her, and yet she is, you know, she's 42. She's a church, you know, active in her church. She has a kind of middle class demeanor that middle class people also identify with. So she sits on this interesting line. And then that, you know, her working class politics, I think, really continue in Detroit. They move to Detroit 8 months after the boycott ends in 1957. Both her and her husband lose their jobs. They're getting constant death threats. Those do not end when the boycott ends, nor are they able to find work when the boycott ends. And so she moves to Detroit, and she's very active in the labor movement. You know, I mean, supportive of the labor movement in Detroit. Actually, during the boycott, She is invited to Detroit by Local 600, which is a fairly, one might say, militant local in the UAW. And so she very much kind of identifies with the union movement in Detroit when she gets there.
Talk a little bit about her involvement in the 63 March on Washington.
Mm-hmm. So one of the sort of controversies at the 1963 March on Washington is that no woman is asked to speak. No woman speaks at the March on Washington. And even before that glorious day, there's, you know, a number of women behind the scenes began to raise this question to A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, who are organizing the march, that, you know, no woman has been asked to speak. And so this weird compromise is made where they're going to do a tribute to women, where women, a handful of very important women in struggle are going to get to stand up and be recognized. And so Rosa Parks is one of those women who gets to be on the dais that day and stand up, although she and a number of other women are still sort of appalled by the fact that no woman gets to speak. And then Gloria Richardson, who had led the movement in Cambridge, Maryland, tells this story. She's also one of the women who gets to be on the dais that day. And she says her and Lena Horne beforehand are in the media tent, and they're bringing journalists over to interview Rosa Parks, and basically saying, she's who started this all. You need to interview her. And then, as Gloria Richardson tells it, they are sent home early from the march, ostensibly for their own safety, but Richardson believes because her and Lena Horne had the audacity to be saying, you know, you need to recognize Rosa Parks.
How much did she contribute to her own legacy, to the iconic aspects of her life that we talked about at the outset?
I think she contributes in a couple of key ways. One of the things, and one of the reasons that I think this image of kind of a Christian seamstress kind of emerges actually during the boycott itself. And it emerges because, again, this is 1955, this is the Cold War. Civil rights protests had always gotten sort of treated as the act of outside agitators. Immediately, she's accused of being a communist plant, an NAACP plant. And so King and a number of the boycott leaders and Parks herself tend to background her political history, right, during the boycott in many ways to keep the movement safe. So, and she participates in that. Secondly, she is a huge believer in the fact that history helps take the movement forward. Again, as I mentioned before, Black history is this jewel to her, and to her, to telling history is about taking the struggle forward. Now, obviously, what starts to happen by the 80s and 90s is that telling civil rights history simultaneously becomes a way to put it in the past, right? She had worked very hard to get the King holiday, for instance, and she, like many civil rights activists, press, would get a King holiday. And then she's very disappointed by the ways that the King who emerges in that King holiday isn't actually the King that she loved, right? It's a very dreamy, fuzzy King, not a kind of activist, you know, morally strident King, right, who Parks knew. And so I think a similar thing happens to her. So on the one hand, she's willing to kind of turn up and go to all the thousands of programs, right, in many ways to keep the history going, to keep the struggle going. But how she gets sort of, we could say, used or taken up in the process is unfortunately a way to put the movement in the past.
In many ways, though, she seemed very conflicted. On the one hand, she understood the importance of being in the spotlight, the importance of bringing attention to these issues, but on the other hand, she wanted a certain degree of privacy, and she tried to have both and didn't always work out.
Yes, and from the very beginning. So there's this, on the first day of the boycott, right, which is the day that she's arraigned in court, they call the boycott for that first day. So she goes to court that morning. And then instead of going back to work, she goes to Fred Gray. He's the young Black lawyer in town who's representing her. She goes back to his office. He's a friend of hers, to help him and to answer his phones because so many people are calling about the boycott. And she answers the phone that day but admits later that she doesn't tell anybody that it's her. So I think this kind of speaks to how she sort of positions herself, right? She wants to be useful. She wants to be helpful. She doesn't go home. She doesn't go back to work. She wants to be doing something for the movement that day. But she also isn't admitting that it's her. And part of her answering the phones then allows Fred Gray to leave the office and goes to have a meeting that will birth the Montgomery Improvement Association, right, which is the group that is the kind of the organizing group for for the boycott, right? So she stays back to answer phones while Fred Gray and Martin Luther King and others in Montgomery sort of meet, and Edie Nixon meet to sort of make this group. So in many ways, right, her position is in some sense behind the scenes, and that's partly she likes being behind the scenes, and then again, it's partly, I think, the gendered expectations of the time.
In many ways, a very modern dilemma.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He certainly understood that these things needed work and needed people to be willing to do that work.
Jean Theo Harris. The book is The Rebellious Life of Miss Rosa Parks. Jean, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.